Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk with Howard Lyman, who's perhaps the first and best known activist who sounded the alarm in the United States about mad cow disease. His appearance on the Oprah Winfrey Show led to a lawsuit from the Cattlemen's Association, which was ultimately won by Howard Lyman, and Oprah Winfrey was exonerated. He's also the author of a well-reviewed book, Mad Cowboy, and executive director of Voices for a Viable Future. So we'll be talking to him about the mad cow outbreak in the United States. And we'll also talk about domestic terrorism in the context of a great deal of hysteria over the holidays where airlines and airports were shut down. There is also a lot of domestic terrorism that goes somewhat unreported, particularly a recent case down in Texas where a group of right-wing terrorists were stopped from exploding a cyanide bomb, which would have killed hundreds of people. And we'll be talking with Daniel Levitas, who is the author of The Terrorist Next Door, The Militia Movement and the Radical Right. And, of course, prior to 9/11, the greatest act of domestic terrorism in the United States was conducted by a white Christian, Timothy McVeigh. And then we'll talk with Dr. Nikki Keddie, who's a professor emerita at UCLA and the author of 13 books, mostly about Iran. She's also the author of Modern Iran, Roots and Results of Revolution. We'll be talking to her about the earthquake in Bam, which killed a third of the population of that ancient city. I think the earthquake was similar magnitude to the earthquake in Paso Robles here a week or so ago, which killed two people. So we'll be talking about how this earthquake may lead to some thaw between the United States and Iran. And we're looking also at the role of women in terms of liberating Iran from the mullahs. I'm speaking now with Howard Lyman, who is perhaps the first and best-known activist who sounded the alarm in the United States about mad cow disease. And Howard, your appearance on the Oprah Winfrey show, where Oprah said she wasn't going to, after listening to what you had to say, said she wasn't going to eat a hamburger again, led to a lawsuit from the Cattlemen's Association, which subsequently you won. But of course, you were sounding an alarm, which it's taken a long time. How long ago was this appearance, by the way, on the Oprah Winfrey show?
Well, the appearance was April of 1996. I first started publicly speaking about this issue back in 1990. And, you know, it was an amazing thing. Our government and the cattlemen absolutely could not admit to the American people that we had them at risk. And, you know, we got sued in 1996, ended up in court for 6 years, spent hundreds of thousands of dollars defending ourselves, even after the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, in their opinion, said everything I said on the show was true and the truth was not actionable. The cattlemen continued and even sued us in state court. So, you know, it was an amazing thing that they were willing to spend the amount of money they were spending just to keep the media intimidated. And I have to tell you, it worked.
And how are they dodging this particular bullet now with the mad cow?
Well, it was rather interesting. Representative Ackerman said, you know, USDA finally saw the light. Of course, it took being hit by lightning to see it. What's happened right now is that they had bet all of their money that there would never be a case of mad cow disease in the U.S., and lo and behold, when they were only testing 20,526 out of 37 million that were being slaughtered, lo and behold, lightning did strike. They found one. And, you know, this government policy, as far as I'm concerned, has been don't look, don't find, like sending a blind man out to find a needle in a haystack. Well, they ended up finding an animal, and then all of a sudden, nobody wants to believe what they had to say. And so we've still got a ways to go, but they definitely are in a whole different mode today than they were last week.
Well, of course, they're praising the new rules, the very things that they fought against. And I believe the White House, in fact, intervened on a Senate bill that would have banned downer cows from entering the food chain.
Well, you know, when we stop and look at downers, remember that there's about 180,000 non-ambulatory animals in the U.S. that actually get slaughtered. And three-quarters of them, 75% of them, end up in the human food chain. Now, the World Health Organization says every downed animal should be tested for mad cow disease. Out of the 180,000, we're testing totally less than 21,000. So all of a sudden they decide, whoops, by golly, you know, we're going to ban feeding downers to the U.S. We're going to not slaughter them anymore. Well, just stop and take a look at it. Who gets economically disadvantaged with this ruling? Most of the downed animals that are slaughtered in the little mom-and-pop slaughterhouses, not the big multinational outfits. They don't care. They don't take them. Doesn't cost them anything. And when they ban the little guys from doing it, takes about 0.5% of the U.S. meat supply away from competition with them. And so what the USDA did is that they ended up biting the little guys, but they sure didn't hurt the big guys, and they didn't do what they really should have done, which was, number one, quit feeding animals to animals. We're still feeding cow blood back to cows. We're still feeding cows to pigs, chickens, and horses. We're still feeding pigs, chickens, and horses to cows. And the other thing, we should do exactly what countries that have got on top of this issue have done. They basically test the animals that go to slaughter. We have over 7 million head of cattle in the U.S. that are over this 30-month-of-age magic threshold that USDA says that any animal under 30 months of age, you can't show whether they're infected. Why don't they pay attention to what happened in Japan, where Japan, using a test that was developed in the United States, actually found a bull that was under 2 years of age that was infected? So I think when you look at what's coming out of USDA now, you can tell when they're lying, their lips are moving.
Well, clearly the feeding of animal parts to animals led to the major outbreak in the United Kingdom several years ago, and that also crossed the food chain into the, at least the disease, this prion disease, crossed into the human population. 150 people died of this Creutzfeldt-Jakob. I mean, it's a pretty horrendous thing that... Let's just go through this this bovine spongiform encephalopathy and its connection to Creutzfeldt-Jakob, because there was an article I read the other day in the New York, in the LA Times, written by somebody from the Cato Institute, the libertarian group, more or less saying that the connection wasn't really proven. I mean, it's pretty hard not to see how you have an outbreak of mad cow in England and then you have 150 people exhibiting the same symptoms as the animals, and subsequently their brains turning into sponges.
Well, probably the most authoritative people on this issue are the ones in England, and they're basically saying that new variety CJD is about 99.9% sure that it comes from eating infected cows. So I think no matter who wants to stand up and say that it's not proven, you might as well forget about that. What we need to look at, I think, is the fact that we have a long incubation period from the time that a human is infected until they show the symptoms, somewhere between 10 and 40 years. We've had 150 or 60 that have died, but how many are out there that are incubating this disease? In the United States.
And we don't really know how it works, right? It essentially just need one cell that eventually starts all these cells mutating. So it's a bit like a cancer that can lay dormant for a long time.
Well, it's a prion, which is an abnormal protein, right. And the abnormal protein, you know, you can't kill it because it was never alive, but this abnormal protein for some reason is able to transmit a signal to a normal protein, and you have replication where one gets you two gets you four, and basically it eats the hole in the brain. So when we look at all of the issues that are out there, I don't think anybody knows yet what the magnitude of this problem could be. On the Oprah show, I said that we had the potential to have a disease to make AIDS look like the common cold. I still have not changed my opinion on that for one reason. If we look at the amount of Alzheimer's in the United States in 1945, it was absolutely minuscule. Today, there are over 500,000 confirmed diagnoses of Alzheimer's. When they actually took Alzheimer patients that died, demented patients that died, removed their brain and checked them, in the Pittsburgh Veterans Study, 5% of them really had CJD. In another study that was replicated in Yale University, 13% had CJD. Let's just say that maybe 10% of the demented diagnoses out there are incorrect. There's 10% of the demented people that really have CJD. That means we have 50,000 cases. And all of the powers to be want to say to the American people, there's only one case of CJD per million inhabitants. That means that we have less than 300 that are coming from genetics. Where in the world are the other 47,000 in this country coming from? I think we are being less than forthright with the American people, with our government, and when we talk about the spongiform diseases.
Well, I think the consumers aren't quite aware of how pervasive these products from cows are in all kinds of, they're in cosmetics and all kinds of things you wouldn't expect. And it apparently is to do with wanting to use every scrap of this animal that leads to this prion disease entering into the human population.
Well, if you look at it, about half of the slaughter weight of an animal is not saleable for human consumption. And so then you end up with those products going into things like soap, marshmallows, gel caps. Gelatin happens to be hoofs, hides, and horns. And they have shown in the laboratory in England that gelatin can be infectious. When we look at all of these products that are out there, the magnitude of the problem, the lack of surveillance, we do not require doctors to report dementing diseases. No one in the United States of America knows how many people are infected with demented diseases out there, and how in the world are we going to get on top of this issue when we don't even know the magnitude of what we're talking about?
So in other words, you could actually, rather, if you ate a cow's brain, if you ate a brain from a downer cow, and a downer is a, why people think that you could slaughter an animal that clearly can't walk and is demonstrably sick. But if you ate the brain of a downer cow, you'd have a good chance of getting Creutzfeldt-Jakob. But on the other hand, are you saying that if you have a marshmallow, you could get it?
They do not know how slight the amount of material that it takes. But in England, they were using infected animals and feeding them to other animals, and they were finding that it took less than a gram of infected material to infect a cow. If you take something in the size of a cow, if you can infect them with less than a gram, you can look at the problem with a human. It would be a minuscule amount of infected material. Now,
this is material, by the way, that somehow gets into the flesh of the animal that is cooked for human consumption and then ingested, and then it's passed on. So whatever this chain of infection is, this prion is extremely resilient, it would seem.
Well, remember that we're talking about something that's not alive, that will survive a temperature of 1,000 degrees. So, there's no cooking that we're doing in the kitchen. There's no cooking in the rendering process that is going to deactivate this material.
Let me just again remind the audience here that I'm speaking with Howard Lyman, who is perhaps the best known activist who first sounded the alarm in the United States about mad cow disease. His appearance on the Oprah Winfrey Show led to a lawsuit from the Cattlemen's Association, which was ultimately won by Howard Lyman, and he and Oprah Winfrey were exonerated, although the cattlemen, as he mentioned, kept suing and suing, obviously, to send signals to the press in general to back off. And now they've had to praise the very reforms that they've resisted for so long in the wake of the appearance of one infected cow in Washington State. And he's also the author of Mad Cowboy and the executive director of Voices for a Viable Future. And tell me about Mad Cowboy. And your website is what, madcowboy.com?
Yeah, my website is madcowboy.com. We have a section on there that we update every day about what's happening in this mad cow issue that is out there. We're ending up with people all over the world now accessing that website, and it's probably one of the most used websites on this issue right now in the nation.
And Howard, what's the answer apart from becoming vegetarians?
Well, remember that consumers, I believe, will drive this fight. Every dollar you spend, you're voting on the future. I think right now that what happens in the future is going to be more dictated about Japan, whether they continue to embargo U.S. beef. They are our largest customer. They take about 10% of our beef is exported. We have the most expensive cattle in the history of the United States in feedlots. The price has dropped about 20%. We have an economic disaster out there. The government is trying to get everybody to look at it and say there's no problem, continue to eat beef. That will not happen. If Japan does what I believe they should do, and take in a mandate that we test all animals and quit feeding animals back to animals, we will probably see this industry changed markedly. And if we don't, I think that this flimsy recovery we have in this nation may actually go by the board just because of this issue.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Howard Lyman.
Well, it's been a joy, and Happy New Year's to all of my friends.
Thank you, Howard.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Hello again. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm just speaking then with Howard Lyman, who was the first to sound the alarm about mad cow disease in the United States. His appearance on the Oprah Winfrey Show led to a lawsuit from the Cattlemen's Association. And Howard, of course, is a fourth-generation Montana cattle rancher who is now a vegetarian, needless to say. I'm speaking with Daniel Levitas, who's the author of The Terrorist Next Door, The Militia Movement and the Radical Right. And you had an opinion piece recently in the New York Times, Daniel, where you talked about this little-known right-wing extremist group down in Texas who actually created a functioning cyanide bomb, which, for all intents and purposes, is a weapon of mass destruction. And while we're hearing all about airlines being grounded and searched and general hysteria, where Al-Qaeda has managed to spoil everybody's vacation and create a great deal of anxiety and a sort of lathering of foaming at the mouth pundits on television talking about, and these so-called terrorist experts going on about terrorism. Here in the United States, right under our noses, if we don't remember Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma, these people that you've uncovered are here to remind us that we have a domestic terrorism problem here in the United States.
Well, we do indeed, and even more pointedly, this fully functional sodium cyanide explosive device that was found in a storage locker in East Texas near the town of Noonday. It should be pointed out this was the home state of President George Bush. I doubt very seriously whether someone who was Muslim or with links to Al-Qaeda or a known violent Islamic terrorist group, if they had been found with a functional chemical weapon in Texas, I'm sure we would have heard straight from John Ashcroft. And I doubt that it would have been met with the kind of silence that we've seen from the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. Now, in defense of the local officials there in Texas, the U.S. Attorney's Office there has been pursuing this case very, very aggressively. They've issued more than 150 subpoenas in connection with the investigation. Three people were arrested in April. They have all now pled guilty. But what is of concern is that they are allegedly not cooperating with the authorities. There were a lot of other explosives, a lot of other components, a quantity of acids and toxic chemicals for use in building additional explosives, briefcase bombs, components for landmines, more than 500,000 rounds of ammunition found, and it is unclear really what, if anything, this material was going to be used for and if there was a definitive plot. So the investigation is still ongoing.
Well, what makes these people, I mean, what is their ideological outlook and why would they want to kill masses of Americans and to make whatever point they want to make? I mean, to some extent, you can understand Al-Qaeda's motives and bin Laden in his various statements has made it clear that why he hates America and particularly the Saudi government, who he wants to overturn. What is the agenda of these Christian identity, Aryan nation type people? What are they?
Well, the individuals that were arrested in Texas and the leader that was identified by law enforcement is a man by the name of William Krar. And Krar is from New Hampshire originally. He's a dealer in gun parts, but also a tax protester. So his opposition to the federal government extends to his refusal to pay federal income taxes. And in the storage locker, there were found copies of the Turner Diaries and another book, Hunter. The Turner Diaries, some of your listeners may recall, was a book written by the neo-Nazi fellow by the name of William Pierce, who actually died a year or so ago. But it offered, among its pages, among other things, the blueprint for the fertilizer and fuel oil bomb that Timothy McVeigh used to destroy the Oklahoma City Federal Building. And, in fact, pages of the Turner Diaries were found in McVeigh's car when he was arrested. So there was neo-Nazi revolutionary literature, Aryan white supremacist literature, Klan literature found in the storage locker. Krar is known to be a tax protester, is known to have anti-government views. Another defendant in the case who has also pled guilty, a man by the name of Edward Feltus from New Jersey, he was active, allegedly a supporter of the militia movement in New Jersey. The third person arrested was Krar's common law wife. Well, what's their agenda? Well, it's no different in many respects from that of Al-Qaeda in the sense that it is theologically inspired, and it derives from a belief that the government of the United States is a diabolical force of evil in the thralls of an international Jewish conspiracy, and that the government is so corrupted by the tentacles of this conspiracy that it needs to be brought down or destroyed. Now, that's in general terms, in terms of people in the movement. I can't speak specifically to Krar's theological or religious motivations, if any. There was no evidence found in the storage locker that I know of that he was a follower of Christian identity theology, this theology that teaches that Jews are the children of Satan and white Anglo-Saxons are the descendants of the lost tribes of Israel. But we can say that the literature tracks what has been found in many other places where people who are self-described Aryan revolutionaries have similarly been stockpiling weapons, ammunition, pipe bombs, and so on in pursuit of their goal, which is to bring about the destruction of the government of the United States, to provoke a race war, and in the end, in their phantasmagorical world, to create an all-white Aryan Christian republic, so to speak.
Well, there's no question that we're quick to talk about Islamic terrorism. I mean, it's become a buzzword used all the time in the media. Why not use the term Christian terrorists? I mean, why this double standard?
Well, I think it's it's not a term that kind of artfully rolls off people's tongues and one that they can really relate to. I think the double, you know, the double standard ought to be obvious, that Christianity and Christian theology is thought of by the vast majority of all Americans as a beneficent theological force of good in the world. It's not associated in any way with evil. And on the other hand, when people are asked about their opinions of Arabs or of Islam, it is much easier to create an association that is negative. I myself do not use the term Christian terrorist in connection with most of the people in the white supremacist and neo-Nazi movement that I study, because in point of fact, many of them, although there is a theological component to their inspiration, their motives are largely political, and I think it's most important to see it in that light. And even the shorthand of Islamic terrorist associated with Osama bin Laden does short shrift to the political agenda of al-Qaeda and others. These movements are political movements. They have a well-thought-out political agenda. Many of the people in these groups, regard fascism as an ideal, though failed, political experiment to be rekindled. That's one of the reasons why they deny the Holocaust, because if you can say that the Nazis didn't exterminate 6 million Jews, then that can somehow rehabilitate fascism as a workable political ideology. So they are terrorists in the sense that they're trying to coerce society and governments to adopt particular political and social programs and to use violence as the tool of that coercion. But oftentimes the theological element is just one of many elements. I mean, what should we call people like James Kopp, who killed Barnett Slepian, the abortion clinic provider, the doctor in Buffalo, New York? Should we refer to James Kopp as a Christian terrorist or as an anti-abortion terrorist or what have you? I prefer to place it in the context of his fanatically anti-abortion views, which certainly you then have to speak to the theological and religious motivation. And the point is one you raised initially, which is the salient one, why all this focus on people outside of America who want to do us harm, to the exclusion almost of people who are very similar right here in this country, who call themselves patriots, call themselves defenders of the Constitution, and yet they still want to kill blacks, Jews, and government officials. You know, there's some ton of serious tunnel vision on this issue that needs to be corrected.
But there is, in terms of bin Laden and Rudolph and McVeigh, and you can extend this to the Reverend Robinson and Falwell and all of the televangelists who make a living out of this drumbeat of Armageddon, which is an apocalyptic idea that there's going to be a violent end to the world, which these people welcome and encourage and want to have happen in order to cleanse the world of sinners, and only the good Southern Baptists will rise up in the rapture and the rest of us will fry in hell. And it's quite possible that our own President of the United States believes in this insanity.
Well, I think an important distinction needs to be made about whether or not one believes in the imminent nature of Armageddon and apocalypse, and then, as you said, the cleansing and the remaking of the world, or
whether
that's,
isn't that pretty violent? Isn't that a terroristic act to blow the world up?
Well, let me say further, the distinction ought to be made between having that belief and then believing that it is incumbent upon you to actually take action to bring about that violent apocalypse itself. I mean, that is really one of the distinguishing features, where you had the Aryan revolutionaries of the order in the 1980s. What they were planning on doing was, you know, they robbed Brink's armored car, more than $3 million, largest armored car heist in the history of the United States. The money was never found. They spread the money throughout the neo-Nazi movement. This is 20 years ago, mind you, so this is nothing new. It's been going on for two decades and more. And they were hoping to bring about a race war and thereby hasten this apocalypse. And that exactly is the theme of the Turner Diaries. I think that when we look at the apocalyptic kind of end times theology of Falwell and Robertson, there is much in it that I find morally and ethically and theologically reprehensible. And one can certainly point to specific actions. For example, the point of view of many on the Christian right with regard to the Middle East, where they are trying to interfere with the peace process there because what they really want to encourage is an Armageddon so that Christ can return, because to them in the Bible it's foretold that, you know, these events need to take place in the Middle East before Christ will return. I think there are certainly actions and words that come from the Christian right which are encouraging us in a dangerous direction in terms of Middle East policy, but that still is not the same as building a sodium cyanide weapon, carrying it into a bus station or an office building or wherever you might happen to be, and detonating it. And there is a distinction.
Well, if there's a distinction, the results are certainly the same. I mean, you can argue that McVeigh really wasn't a Christian, but he certainly saw himself as a Christian. But let me get a sense of where law enforcement stands on this, if there's any ambivalence. Because, you know, the Attorney General of the United States, John Ashcroft, who is the number one lawman in the country, in 1996, he appeared in a right-wing videotape saying that the United Nations was planning a takeover of the United States government in order to rob citizens of our civil liberties. I mean, where does he stand if on the one hand he's a hero of these nutcases, and on the other hand he's the number one lawman?
Well, I'm not familiar with that specific video that you referenced, but of course John Ashcroft's endorsement of the Jefferson Davis, the former president of the failed Confederacy, and his speaking out in publications friendly to the neo-Confederate, as we call it, movement, declaring that, you know, these men of the secessionist South were, you know, men of great honor who were pursuing a great patriotic aim, so to speak. I mean, Ashcroft's statements there to me are troubling enough, as has been the Justice Department position on the Second Amendment, which is very similar, in fact, to what we've heard from many in the militia movement over the years.
Right, and John Ashcroft specifically in the USA Patriot Act and in all of these efforts to make America more secure following 9/11, the one thing that John Ashcroft has made sure that no law enforcement agency can gather is information about firearms. And in fact, in Al-Qaeda's own handbook, they say, don't bring your guns into the United States. You know, they'll get intercepted at the airports. You can buy them in America freely, thanks to people like John Ashcroft.
And how right they are about how freely they can be obtained. That and apparently everything else, going back to this Texas case, landmine components, pipe bombs, black powder, et cetera.
Law enforcement, FBI, cannot get information about purchases of handguns. They can find out what the terrorists or potential terrorists had for breakfast and what books they get out of the library, but they can't find out whether they bought guns. I mean,
well, I think that the going directly to your question about where is law enforcement on this issue, and is there a lack of vigor in terms of proceeding against the paramilitary right wing and others, for example, in the anti-abortion movement, who've used murder and violence and bombs in pursuit of their cause. Unfortunately, what has happened over the years is that within the Bureau, the FBI, there has never really been the kind of system of career incentives for the surveillance and arrest and prosecution of white supremacists and neo-Nazis. Now, if you're going after people who commit real crimes, and I put that in quote, like bank robbery, murder, kidnapping, and so on, well, then there's a lot of gold stars you can pin to your chest. But if you're busting white supremacists and neo-Nazis, well, it's questionable how many pins you're going to get in your lapel in that regard. Now, I think actually that the culture of the Bureau and the Justice Department is changing in that regard, specifically because of the drumbeat having to do with the war on terrorism, and it is more possible today to make the credible argument, as many of us have been making for 20 years. I've been in this business for about 20 years, that white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups are essentially criminal organizations that exist for the sole purpose of terrorizing citizens of color, Jews, gays, lesbians, and others, and doing so with violence, not just with words, but with actions. And now it is a bit easier to point to the plethora of right-wing groups and say that they are terrorists, and to motivate and mobilize the Justice Department to do what they should be doing. Now, I'm not calling for increased powers along the lines of the USA Patriot Act. In fact, this case in Texas was uncovered not through any secret new aggressive powers of the Patriot Act. It was uncovered by accident when Krar mailed a package of fake IDs to his cohort in New Jersey, and the package was misdelivered in the U.S. mail. And an alert person who got it delivered to them opened it up and called the police, and that set in motion a regular investigation. I mean, I think we need to be very careful when we focus on the shortcomings, to whatever extent they are, exist within the Justice Department and other law enforcement agencies in pursuing the criminals of the radical right. We need to be careful that we ourselves are not calling for a persecution of them because of simply their beliefs, but instead are calling for an aggressive prosecution of people who are engaging in criminal activity. And that's the point. And it is goes back to maybe this distinction between Pat Robertson and Eric Rudolph. We do have the right of freedom of speech in this country. You can get on the airwaves and say the most pernicious, stupid, foolish things. We've had Jerry Falwell do it, and scores of people die halfway around the planet in Muslim-Hindu riots in India because of Falwell's statements on the CBS program 60 Minutes insulting Islam. You can't send Jerry Falwell to jail for that, and you can't open a Justice Department investigation against him, and you shouldn't. But if you're Eric Rudolph and you're blowing up abortion clinics and gay bars and bombing the Olympics, allegedly, you know, it ought to take the FBI a little less than 5 years to find you.
Well, just a few weeks ago, the so-called Reverend Robertson said, recommended that the United States military drop a nuclear bomb on the State Department.
Well, actually said we should put a nuclear device there, but yeah, it was the same thing, and it was interesting to note that we sometimes people of progressive, liberal, or left ilk like to lump all those on the right and conservative spectrum together, and this was one of those interesting cases where Robertson was so far out to lunch with that comment that nonetheless a person, Robert Boucher, who's got quite impeccable conservative credentials over there in the State Department. I mean, Boucher flew off the handle and denounced Robertson for this.
But again, George Bush didn't.
No, Bush did not speak to it, but Colin Powell did. And in the past,
Colin
in
Powell.
Fact, Bush has criticized statements made by Robertson. But the dynamic that exists here is really one in which those organizations on the ultra-right or the conservative right, like the Christian Coalition, like Falwell, Concerned Women for America, Focus on the Family, the kind of Christian right organizations, their statements become so extreme, so outrageous, and then those even further to the right than them, the paramilitary violent right, the anti-abortion killers, and the Aryan Nations types, that this exists as a dynamic which then makes ultra-conservatives even seem like they're mainstream. And then it makes middle-of-the-road neoliberal Democrats seem like left-wing lunatics. And those of us and those others who might be even slightly to the left of the center of the political spectrum, why, you know, they then can appear completely out of bounds. I mean, the whole dynamic of political discourse and action in the country has really been shifted very heavily to the right. And many people are too quick, I think, to point to the religious right or the paramilitary right, certainly, and say it's a fringe movement. It only involves a small number of people. Why should we be troubled? They don't say that about the Christian Coalition, but they do say that about the white supremacist groups often. And my response to that, and as I tried to outline in my book, The Terrorist Next Door, that these groups exert a dynamic political influence on all of our institutions, and their ideas do penetrate and migrate to and are co-opted by the political center. And you can't simply dismiss social movements like the paramilitary right because their following is relatively small in numbers compared to 280 million people in the whole country.
Right, and the most powerful man in the United States Congress, Tom DeLay, has views that are not too different from these extremists. And the bottom line is that weapons of mass destruction have not been found in Iraq, but a weapon of mass destruction turned up in Noonday, Texas.
Certainly a fully functional chemical weapon would have killed several hundred people. I don't know what the dictionary definition of a weapon of mass destruction is, but the point being, if we had found this thing in Iraq, we wouldn't have heard the end of it. If we had found it in Texas or New Jersey, for that matter, and the guy in possession of it was named Khalid or Muhammad, we would have heard from John Ashcroft personally with a press conference, you know, within a couple of hours. In this case, those arrests were made in April. The Justice Department in Texas, not in Washington, issued a terse news release to that effect. Then we went all the way through to November with virtually no news about the case until the guilty pleas on November 26th. And to date, the only national news outlets to publish anything on the story have been CNN and the Christian Science Monitor. Granted, the New York Times ran my op-ed piece about a month ago, and now more media is looking into it, largely because that op-ed has triggered stuff. But it really begs the question, why aren't people more concerned about white supremacist, Klan-affiliated, militia movement supporters stockpiling huge amounts of weapons, ammunition, toxic chemicals? Why doesn't the media cover that story as fully as they covered the non-story, I would say, of Jose Padilla, the suspected Al-Qaeda sympathizer, gang member, who allegedly was going to explode a dirty bomb in America, which turned out.
Well, Daniel, I'm afraid we've run out of time, and I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Bye-bye.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking there with Daniel Levitas, the author of The Terrorist Next Door, The Militia Movement and the Radical Right. I'm now speaking with Professor Nikki Keddie, who's a professor of history emerita at UCLA, the author of 13 books, mostly on Iran, the most recent being Modern Iran, Roots and Results of Revolution. And Professor Keddie, the historic town of Bam was essentially wiped out by this earthquake. I believe it had the same similar power to the earthquake in Paso Robles, but a third of the population, 35,000 apparently, were killed, and the Iranian government welcomed assistance from all countries of the world, including the United States, with the exception of Israel. But what's happened in terms of a follow-through? There was a delegation supposed to go from the United States, headed by Elizabeth Dole, and the Iranian government have turned it down.
They didn't quite turn it down. They said that it would be held in abeyance, that it was not an appropriate time right now, so that possibly not that very same delegation, but if things improve in our relations, some other high-level delegation could go. I should say that many people think that George Bush's coupling of talking about this aid with setting up a series of conditions for Iran, which presumably should be the subject of talks and not conditions before we have talks, conditions about Israel and Al-Qaeda, really made it very difficult for the Iranians to accept further warming of relations at that time.
Well, there's always, from going back to the hostage crisis, and then Oliver North's McFarlane's trip to Iran, and all the way through the coverage of the split in Iran between these two governments. There's always been this notion of the hardliners and the moderates. And still to this day, that is the dichotomy that we seem to look at Iranian politics as they're evolving since the Islamic Revolution back in 1979. So can you give us some more wisdom? Surely it's not that simple.
No, it isn't that simple. It's so complicated that one couldn't cover it all in a couple of minutes. But I should say that at the time that Oliver North and these people were saying this, the question of moderates and pragmatists was really a kind of a dubious one. Obviously, there were differences, but there was not the kind of reformist group which now holds the presidency and the parliament and really would like better relations with the U.S., among many other things that they would like. So that that has existed since the election of President Khatami in 1997. However, even that isn't that simple. That is, one cannot say that if you're not with Khatami, then you're not for better relations with the U.S. It's not quite clear where the really powerful figure Khamenei stands on this, and he may be open to better relations, but not in terms that the U.S. should dictate what the outcome of any talks would be.
But don't the hardliners, isn't there raison d'etre to hate America? Because that is sort of essentially the gives them a free pass.
Yes, and to that degree, when we make hostile statements like Iran is one of the three members of the Axis of Evil, that this strengthens that view that nothing can be done to improve relations with the U.S. But Iran's government also has some reasons to want better relations, and that's perhaps primarily economic. That is, that they would like more foreign investment, maybe eventually down the road even being members of the World Trade Organization and things of this sort. They have major economic problems. I don't think they're at the moment scared of a U.S. invasion. I mean, some of the articles about what's going on now imply that this is Iran's being more open to U.S. aid in the earthquake, etc., are due to America's hard line on international relations. But I think that the difficulties, to put it mildly, that we're having in Iraq and the fact that our 150,000 soldiers and such are tied up there means that the Iranians are not afraid at this point that the U.S. is going to attack them.
Well, isn't it clear, Professor Nikki Keddie, that the Iranians could do much more to make life difficult for the United States in Iran and appear to be showing some restraint?
In Iraq.
In Iraq, yes.
Yes, of course they could. Iranians and the Iranian government and the U.S. government are not in totally hostile positions in relation to international relations. That is, the Iranians are not unhappy with things sort of as they are in Iraq, and they don't necessarily want things to be worse in Iraq. That is to say, if things calm down a little, the Shiites would have a lot of power, presumably, in Iraq, and that wouldn't be a bad thing for Iran. So in many ways, they are not being uncooperative, let's say, in relation either to Iraq or Afghanistan. In both places, the existing government has actually been helpful to the U.S.
Well, tell me about what's likely to happen then with the parliamentary elections coming up. There's just 6 weeks away, and there's a sense that the reformers, because they keep getting overruled by the hardliners, haven't been able to deliver on their promises, and that the young, and in particular the women who support reform and who want to get rid of the strictures of the Islamic Revolution, are sort of giving up. So is there a two-track thing happening here, that socially Iran is becoming more open and liberal, but politically it's just in the doldrums?
Well, to some degree, yes. Certainly in my book I talk about a lot of the social changes and intellectual changes that have really been quite striking in Iran. I think that elections in Iran are notoriously difficult to predict. Virtually nobody predicted Khatami's original victory, even though it turned out to be overwhelming. But the issue is whether a lot of people will simply not vote. Because if they voted, I think, well, there are two issues, let's say. First, there's a council that has to vet candidates and decide which candidates to allow, but I don't think they could in a wholesale way, and that's a conservative council, but I don't think they could in a wholesale way knock out, you know, most of, or a huge number of reformers and not allow people to vote for reformers. But there are two lines of approach which are even taken by politicized people. One is that you should keep voting for the reformers and keep pushing, even though the reformist parliament's reform measures keep getting turned down by the council that has the power to do so. And the other is that you should boycott the elections. And then there are a lot of people who might just shrug their shoulders, as a lot of people do in the U.S., and say, well, it doesn't really make any difference in practice who I vote for. So I think the question is how big a turnout there is. If there's a really big turnout, I think there probably will still be a reform vote. If a lot of people don't turn out, it's happened in the municipal elections, and that would favor the conservatives.
But I believe, though, that for example, the religious police, not so long after the revolution, you could be disappeared into prison and murdered and tortured for showing too much leg or too much hair. Now, I understand young Iranian women defy the religious police openly.
Yeah, it's almost as if there were kind of a tacit agreement because there has been so much defiance, especially by the young and by many women, that the government will allow a lot of these social changes to take place. I mean, you even have boys and girls or young men and young women holding hands in some of the major cities. I have a photo of that in my book. And going off to mountain areas and mixing on the weekends and things of that sort, which I should say did not exist before the revolution in such numbers in many cases. But so you have those things, although you have occasional crackdowns, and parties can be held with bribes, so that you have them allowing some of these social changes, but on the other hand, not legal changes, which are very important. Not the legal reforms which the parliament has tried to put through on issues of women and other issues have been turned down.
But what does it say, though, about the broader issue of how you democratize the Middle East, given this neoconservative vision that President Bush is trying to sell in Iraq? I mean, clearly it's taken a generation of this revolution to grind to a halt. Apparently, the population in Iran is sick to death of the mullahs, and that Sharia Islamic rule by the book, basically, you know, the Quran doesn't tell you how to. First of all, I don't think I think it's a misinterpretation of the Quran in the first place, but it doesn't tell you how to deliver the garbage and have good governance. So what's the answer here? I mean, you got the Iranian model where people just get tired of it and want freedom after a long period, and then you have the Algerian example where they stopped the Islamists from getting into government, and now they've just had a constant bloodletting. So what does it tell us about how the West can influence political development. Of course, in the case of Iran, the Americans and the British have are guilty of preventing the evolution of politics in Iran back in the 50s with the coup against Mossadegh and the installation of the Shah. So we're not exactly the most credible people to be preaching democracy.
Yes, I'd start out by saying that outside intervention, well, specifically U.S., but it goes for other countries too, of a violent kind, has, to my knowledge, never encouraged democracy, and quite the opposite. If you go to U.S., used to support coups in Guatemala, in Iran, in Chile. All of these certainly have resulted in undemocratic and indeed deaths of lots of people, and invasions and occupations have never resulted in increasing democracy, and this is just a fantastic idea put forth by the neocons and Bush, that you can get democracy in that way. You might temporarily get some kind of constitution, but this is not a way you can get democracy. And in relation to people, places like Iran, it seems to me you just the people there have to keep pushing. And that, as far as the outside is concerned, what's been generally the Western European and even Russian approach of improving relations and dialogue and sometimes setting up some, let's say, a few conditions. I mean, in the case of Britain, they set up the condition about Rushdie, certainly, and things of that sort. But you can't say you've got to democratize your government or we won't deal with you. I think it goes the other way around. You begin the dealings, and that encourages greater freedom.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Professor Nikki Keddie.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Professor Nikki Keddie. He's a professor emerita of history at UCLA, the author of 13 books, mostly on Iran, including the most recent, Modern Iran, Roots and Results of Revolution. I thank Zubri Fields for the engineering today and Louis Vandenberg for producing and research on this program, which can be got at ianmasters.org. This program and all previous background briefings are archived at ianmasters.org.